July 16th, sorry, 2019 session of TeamSpeak for Tangerine SDR. My name is Dave, KV0S, and this week I've been working on a bit on the programming stuff. A lot of programming projects I'm working on right now are in the point where they need massive reorganizations. So I've been working on that and understanding some of the, spending some time learning more about the areas that are vague, and instead of just depending on the code that I have to work, I want to fully understand the process of what it's doing. So I've been spending time doing that, and that's about it for me. Next on the list, we have Dave, KD0EAG. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello, yes. I can't say that I have had accomplished a lot in the last week. Seems like I've been spinning my wheels various ways. A little bit of programming, but not very much. But all in all, it's just summer and the usual things going on. So that kind of keeps me from doing much more than following what others are producing. So, but I've been following the changes to the specifications and things that people have been putting up and with interest. And so, otherwise, I'm not much to say for myself. Over.
Well, fine business, Dave. And next on the list, we have Mike AAAK showing his recording in a way, or Mike muted. And we thank Mike for posting the TeamSpeak recording to tsarchive.tangerinesdr.com. Next on the list, we have Rick, W2GPS. Go ahead, Rick.
Well, good evening, everyone. I missed the last two TeamSpeak meetings, and I'm sorry about that. I've been going through quite the trauma here as I decided to evacuate all five bedrooms and the second floor of the house and have the whole second rebuilt at the same time. One of those rooms is the ham shack, of course. So I'm still in withdrawal symptoms not having a ham shack. But the project is done, and we're beginning to put stuff back where it came from slowly. And between that and work, all I've been able to do is with Tom and others on the specification for the GPS tiered oscillator module. Still a lot of work, but at least the preliminary documents are out for everybody to see. But we've actually got to do some real work pretty soon, and we're not quite sure if what we want to do can be done with the within the cost constraint of the project, but we're going to try. That's all I have.
Well, fine business. And next on the list, we have Tom N5E. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, Dave. Good evening to everybody. It's been another busy week, and I have a long list. Fortunately, Scotty's on, so he's listening. Let's see. I uploaded a few documents to the documents folder. Tangerine SDR created an older docs folder and moved the obsolete of the spec docs folder. Secondly, I received Midwest VHF UHF Society noise source, a 5D excess noise, and used it to measure my Hermes Alex comp. And Alex, for those who may or may not know, is a filter. But in the sixth position, it also has, and I was able to measure, verify the preamp as a four noise figure. The design is designed for 6 meters and up in many gigahertz range. And we're going to need to modify it to bring its noise response down, probably, I think, increase the noise. My guess, look, parts is the parts cost for the noise source will be $3. And then if we need a relay to switch it, there's probably another $2.50. Right now, the noise source DC, I think we may be able to lower that, perhaps down 5 volts to Zener. Current Zener is a 7 volt Zener. And that's the higher voltage Zeners have less capacitive work frequency range, but since we're not interested in voltage. Next, I updated the interface control document of the clock module based upon Rick's comments. Fourth, I've created a requirements document for the magnetometer, the local range extender, and remote range extender modules. And I tried to make it all work over a single, basically, device, creates REI signals and loops back RN. One of the difficulties I found is that the S on SP is a gapped clock, so it toggles 8 bits and then stops. And since 4 signals SPI use all 4 of the lines, that makes a power low voltage kludge of power Ethernet not have any spare. I think it may still, by doing an extra read, thing started, but maybe not. If it doesn't, within a second for power. I hate to put in 2 cables because the odds that somebody will hook up the power cable, the signal, and the signal cable, probably about 1%. Scotty, thanks for the initial sketch of the data engine. Boy, I got that. I'm starting to look at 2 questions. Number 1, mounting holes. The main DE board, I didn't notice where those affix them down to a chassis or something. And then secondly, you may want to comment on where the magnetometer or the local extender would plug into that main. I didn't see connectors, maybe, but I don't know what it is. So I tried to create a 32-bit WAV file, the new radio, but it doesn't like. It turns out found a 2-bit format that uses floating point for the WAV, and it's supported by Audacity. But the GNU radio block doesn't know anything about it. It only supports 860 watts. I tried to upload that to Scotty's FTP site, but I have a feeling that the user, Scotty, may not be a member of the group that's allowed to upload and download FTP files. So that's a possibility. And looking through the FTP site, else are created and owned by root. So that's it. That's it for
fine business. And next on the list, Phil came in and he jumped up 3 steps. So Phil W1PJE, go ahead. Phil, are you there?
Can you hear me now?
Yep, just fine.
Okay, great. I'm here on behalf of the HamSci Collective, as Nathaniel may have mentioned. I think last time we're going to try to do a bit of a round robin, have about 5 of us signed up kind of in a rotating format so that at least one HamSci is around for most of these calls, or one of us will find a substitute. So my job here is to listen to what's going on, and if anybody has any questions about things that I can take back to the HamSci team, please feel free to throw those in. In the meantime, I'm kind of just going to be catching myself up to speed on all of the hard work that other people have been doing here. So I'll leave it at that for now.
Well, fine business, and I'm glad to have you here. Next on the list, we have Scotty, DA2DFI. Go ahead. Sorry, W8. Go ahead, Scotty.
Okay, hello there. Thanks, Dave, for stepping in and running the show again. It's always good to have a professional doing it since you got so many years. You make it sound so easy. Anyway, and welcome to Phil, too, for standing in here for the hams. And just want to make sure you did know that Mike does post recordings. So if anybody wants to listen after the fact and find out what happened, that the recordings are up on, I think Dave said, tsarchive.tangerine.sdr, tangerinesdr.org, .com, rather. As Tom mentioned, I did get the, I posted kind of my idea of a picture of how the boards are going to plug together with some sizes of the boards, mins and maxes, or typical and maxes. And not sure that everything will fit together exactly like that, but that's kind of my thought of putting the Raspberry Pi board and or a Leaf board. I'm calling our expansion boards a Leaf, which stands for Low Speed Expansion Adapter. I forget what the F stands for. Maybe Tom can fill you in. It's been a long day here. So anyway, the idea is that we could take a standard Raspberry Pi hat and plug it into a standard Raspberry Pi I/O connector, or we can take our Leaf board and we can plug it into an M2 connector and kind of angle it down and plug it into the Raspberry Pi expansion connector also. So our board, our special design boards, will have lots more I/O available to them than the Raspberry Pi hats will. And that M2 connector allows us to put some high-speed expansion signals out onto the Leaf board. So it'll give us an opportunity to maybe make some interesting add-on boards that you can't really do with a Pi because you don't have any high-speed connections. So, on the top also is space for 2 RF modules that also use M2 connectors but plug on to a different set of connectors. and leaving space for a couple of RJ45s and some USB connectors. Then on the bottom is where the clock module goes on another M2 connector, and in between that and the edge of the board, I guess you'd say, is a couple of PMOD connectors. And I'll get to your question, Tom, on PMODs in just a second. As far as mounting holes go, Tom, I put mounting holes on the board to make the board identical to the Raspberry Pi or the Odroid N2. So it has six holes on the board. I'm not sure they showed up on the diagram so well, but there's the four in the corners where Raspberry Pi goes, and there's a couple additional ones in case you're using an N2 board. So the idea is if you make the Raspberry Pi I/O connector tall enough model, or perhaps use an extender, a male-to-female extender, which they sell, to space the boards further apart, you should be able to still mount the clock board on the bottom of the data engine and still plug the entire assembly on top of an N2 or a Raspberry Pi. They have a physical block of boards that will be in one assembly. And as far as the PMOD connectors go, what those are is it's a 12-pin connection, 12-pin header, right-angle header, 10th-inch center male headers that have 5 volts. You can use 5 or 3-volt ones, but we could use 5-volt ones, and ground, and it has connections for SPI, I2S, and UARTs, all on the same 12 pins. So you can configure them by programming the FPGA to be whichever ports you want, whichever type of port you want to talk to the PMOD. So the idea is, I think your local adapter board, to plug onto the PMOD end. Then you have the RJ45 to a cable, a Cat5 cable, out to the remote adapter board, and then magnetometer module would plug onto that board on the outside. So I'm thinking for the distances we want, perhaps a UART would be a better interface than a SPI interface, and it's much more tolerant to long cables and SKUs and things like that. Especially, we would have the ability then to just drop the baud rate if we wanted to extend the length. But I'm not sure that the controller chip that you're using on the magnetometer, I don't know whether that chip does a UART. I think it does SPI or I2C, but I'm not sure if it does a UART on that, because I think that would kind of be my preferred interface to run over RS-485, give us the most robust communications interface, especially since our data rate is so really low, like only once per second. And let's see, moving on to the next question Tom had, the 32-bit WAV files, do you know what HDSDR requires to pull? Will they play 16-bit WAV files, or do they require 32-bit WAV files? Because I'm not sure. I haven't looked at them to see what they actually produce, because obviously they will play back what they produce, but I'm not sure which one it is that they produce. And and as far as our FTP site, it's definitely broken. I don't know what happened, but it used to work. It doesn't anymore. I haven't done anything except log in a year later, and now it doesn't work. So I'm going to guess you're exactly right. The permissions are messed up, and I have to go back in and fix that. So I will get to that, because it'd be nice to have a way to get one of those big WAV files here to use. And I appreciate your effort in trying to create one that I could actually play back for our Explorer Scouts and have them listen to what Field Day sounds like on the East Coast. So I think that's... one of the other documents I posted was a list of documents, oddly enough, because we're getting so many now, I'm getting a little confused on what the content is in each one. So I more or less made the list for my own to keep it straight in my head, but might be good to have common naming conventions and all that. So tried to put that in there. So if you think that looks okay, fine. If you want changes, then just let me know. We can tweak it around anything looks good. So I guess that's it for me in this week, and back over to Dave. Thanks, Dave.
Well, fine business, Scotty. And next on the list, we have Bill, AB4EJ. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, good evening, Dave, and good evening to the rest of the net there. I did a few things this week. You might have noticed I uploaded a couple of documents. One is an updated functional spec for the local host. Just added a few things based on some things we had talked about in earlier TeamSpeak discussions. Also, I added a new functional specification for the central control system. It's pretty high level, but the detailed design will be where we'll do things like designing the user interface and figuring out how things talk to the database and all that kind of thing. So those are out on the website. I did some further work, the Odroid N2. I've been working with the digital RF team. Rick Voltz he ought to get a raise. I mean, he's really helpful, and he helped me a lot figuring out how to use the mirror utility. I have gotten the N2 to where it will run without skipping. I'm trying to simulate the speed of the Tangerine system by saving everything four times in a feed that comes from a Red Pitaya, which runs at 48 kilosamples per second. For the first time today, I got it to where I could save data continuously without skips. And the way you do that is the John Melton program, PIHPSDR, which I enhanced to be able to output digital RF. You save that to a RAM disk. And then as a separate process, you run a mirror utility, which watches that RAM disk area. And as it sees files appear, it copies those in separate threads over to a spinning hard drive. Now, I don't think I quite have it running up to the speed yet that we'll need, because I ran it for an hour and it did not save as much data as I expected. So either it's missing some, or I don't have it outputting at the right speed. I think probably the latter. So I need some more on that. I have noticed a couple of things. It looks like the digital RF utility, which runs Python, it does appear to be forking off several threads, because you will see if you run HTOP that all of the cores light up at probably around 80% utilization, with sometimes peaking above that. So I think I'm close to driving Odroid N2 close to its maximum level, because as soon as you saturate all the cores, where it just can't go any faster. So we will see. I'll keep you informed on what I learned on that. I have more work to do to verify actually how fast it is possible to output this thing. The other thing is, I spoke a little bit with Rick about how to handle the metadata, and there is a separate utility for that, which I'm probably going to fool around that a little bit this week and learn how to use that. There is a little bit of metadata, some very simple stuff that you save as part of the digital RF output itself, but metadata is handled kind of as a separate item, and there is the utility or two for working with that. So, for example, saving the information such as the center frequency of each channel and some things like that that you need to have a record of that in the file. So, anyway, that's about it for me. Back to Ned.
Very good, Bill. And next on the list, we have Dan in for XWE. Go ahead, Dan.
Hey, Dave. Well, sorry I didn't make it last week. It's the beauty of doing flight training in the Carolinas in the summertime. So pretty bad weather almost all of last week. Anyway, I did finish the Audible book, Seeing in the Dark. That is available as a paperback, I believe. Used, and I would recommend it for anybody who wants to take the time to read it. It's about a 12 or 13 hour read, so it's an investment of time, but it's quite good and very germane to what we're talking about here. I did have a chance to go through the updated documentation and kind of came up to speed on that. 3D printed and for the Tangerine SDR system. As we move a little bit further along, I'll work on that, and we'll have STL files put up someplace that people can download if they want to do their own. We might even be able to find somebody who's willing to do them for us, although generally speaking, 3D printing isn't a real economic way to do things. Anyway, that's about it from here. Back to you, Dave.
Well, fine business. I did want to mention that on Friday night in the OpenHPSDR forum, we noticed that a couple of things. We noticed that the Galileo satellites have been down since last Thursday evening, and they're still working on it. The assumption of what's wrong is one of the sites in it, which deals with clocks is not working with an upgraded software on the satellites. Anyway, and the other thing I wanted to mention is OpenHPSDR. We had some TeamSpeak problems that we got fixed. It was probably an upgrade in the web server that caused the delay, the loss of our directory. So we're back to almost the same configuration as what we have here. So that's it, and we're open for general discussion.
Hi, this is Phil. I had a comment for Bill, if I can.
Go ahead.
Phil, one of the things about the digital RF package is that the reason that we, at Haystack, the reason we separated out the metadata from the regular data is that in the general case, you can have any number of systems generating metadata on completely different time cadences. You could have something that has a data point every 10 seconds versus something that has data at 100 hertz. So you're going to find that the digital metadata is very general and, in fact, will support an asynchronous recording of whenever you have a piece of metadata. It will tag it with the time that you need, and then you record that. So the metadata in there is a little different from the metadata that comes along with the RF channel itself, because that requires interpretive metadata, as you said, sample rate, start time, and that sort of thing. So when you're looking at this at first, it's a little bit hard to distinguish the two of those, but that's why the data package is separate. So for example, a magnetometer that's recording at some other rate could be archived low rate in metadata alongside some stream that's going to digital RF. Please feel free to reach out, as you've been doing, to Ryan or the rest of us about that. We have some experience with this, but we found it to be reasonably flexible.
Yeah, Phil, I hope I didn't misstate. I mean, I wasn't meaning to be critical. It's just so different than from HDF5, which I have more, just a little bit of a learning curve, that's all.
Oh, yes. No, I didn't take it that way. And in fact, you're going to find that digital metadata is, sure enough, recording an HDF5 underneath it. It's just more of an asynchronous record, which is often for metadata. One of the things that is a general thing for the other people on this server is that long time ago, probably in the late 90s, when we were putting together the software radar we have at Haystack, one of the key software patterns that I ended up writing for that was something called a weaver. And the reason I called it that was because you might have five different metadata at five different, and you want to store that data sparsely, yet the user wants to ask for whatever the metadata state is at a given time. And the weaver was the thing that actually time synchronized all of these asynchronous streams in a software agent. So that's another reason why we did it in a separate manner, so that we would be flexible at the back end as to what we wanted from software. Some software doesn't need this view of the system. Sometimes it needs an asynchronous. Just tell me whenever you get a new bit of metadata, since that's already compressed. So there's many, many different ways to use this, but obviously the things that we have to discover here is what's appropriate for this particular Tangerine project. So I'll be interested to see how this one develops compared to some of the other things we had to do.
Yeah, we'll certainly keep you in the loop as more comes out on that. I think we're probably going to have to design it together because this project has a few aspects on it that are a little bit middle of a learning curve for me. So, but anyway, we'll get there.
I have no doubts. When we used to develop this stuff, I remember doing it all in a directory called prototypes, because I wanted to keep the mental stance that we would throw it away whenever we found something better, and that I shouldn't mentally invest too much in what we were doing at the time. So doing this together and incrementally doing it is about the only way to go for my experience. So it'll be fun.
Agreed.
Can I ask you a question about the drawings?
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. You mentioned the mounting for mounting data engine. Does the data engine board mount to the local host, or does the data engine board mount to a chassis? What's the idea?
Well, I think the idea is it could mount to either. So if the local host ends up being an N2 or a Raspberry Pi, then you can mount it directly to that, and then you can mount the whole stack to a chassis. Or if it ends up being a different board, you don't especially if you don't use any of the GPIO connections on the local host, then you can just mount them side by side, or however you want, in a chassis without plugging them together.
Okay. That's so that I was my miss in the document. I was assuming the data would be bolted down to a chassis independent. Those are the mounting holes I was.
Oh, okay. Well, I figured you're going to mount them either to the local host or to the chassis, but you can use the same holes, right? Because you won't be doing both.
Yeah, I couldn't tell. It looked like all the holes I could identify were ones that captivated leaf module or captivated, the M.2 modules to the data engine. And, you know, I can see the orange holes where the pi-hat is. Or were you planning on just those four?
You're talking about just the four holes for the hat?
Yeah. I'm trying to figure out what holes you use to bolt this thing.
Hold on. Let me look at the drawing. Just because I drew it doesn't mean I remember anything about it yet.
I understand.
Okay, so the orange holes are for the leaf or the hat. And then, see, the two black holes down at the bottom are, those will be in the corners of the N2. So those were all I was planning on. We could certainly add holes, but probably going to have to make the board a little bit bigger to add any holes outboard of the leaf or the hat. Because we can put a hole underneath the RF module, but you can't really put one underneath an RJ45.
Yeah, okay. So the two black holes or orange would give you a total of six.
Right. And so if you mounted it over an N2, you would use the upper two orange holes and the lower two black holes, and that would be your four. If you used a Raspberry Pi, then you would mount the Pi and the DE and the hat all together on the same four set of holes, which should be the orange one. And I guess you could extend it even down further with standoffs, so you can mount the whole assembly to the chassis with the same holes.
Okay, I got it. That I think that clears that up.
Perhaps I'm misunderstanding, but haven't the at least the Oidroid people and most of the other people building with these chips go to some trouble to give good heat sinking capability, usually on the, by mounting it on the bottom of the board? So that it wouldn't mount, an N2 wouldn't really mount above this, or am I misunderstanding?
No, the N2 would mount below, so you'd have the N2 at the bottom with its heatsink facing down, and then standoffs, and then you would mount the data engine, and then standoffs, and you would mount the pi hat or leaf board or and RF modules on the top, and the idea is to make the standoffs between the N2 and the data engine tall enough that you can actually mount the clock module in between. And I've seen assemblies that will allow you to do that if you pick the right height standoffs. And then you can extend the Raspberry Pi low-speed I.O. connector with a male-to-female header type extender arrangement.
I understand now. I also wanted to mention that I put that the magnetometer does only support I2C and SPI. I had ordered some differential I2C extenders from SparkFun based on a chip from NXP that they claim will extend them out for 100 feet. Now, what data rate, with I2C, it's a synchronous protocol, it's the clocking rate that you, I don't know how low you can go with it. Usually it's a question of how high. But I was just going to experiment with these little things to see what happened.
Yeah, the two rates that I'm familiar with are typically 400 kilohertz or 4 megahertz. But I think you can go slower because, like you said, it's synchronous. If the hardware will let you generate a clock slower, then it might, you might be able to go slower.
Yeah, Scotty, in the spec, I referenced Texas Instruments, APNA, where they show how to manage the SP fairly into synchronization.
Okay, I'm just concerned over when you started talking about two cables out there, I'm going like, whoa, there's got to be a way to do this with one Cat5.
Well, yeah, that's what I thought as well. The SPI will take four pairs, the clock, master out, slave, the slave master, the return copy of S clock, basically loop S clock, receive and send it transmitter. Unfortunately, that uses four pairs, which are eight wires. And so I would the unit onto those same.
Yeah, and they're using differential pairs, right? So each wire pair is a signal, right?
Yes, that's correct. It's you may want to look at the Texas Instruments app note. It shows they did quite a bit of work in making fast over cables.
Well, okay, if we're running at enough speed, we could use the same way they do power over Ethernet, right? They inject it with on the center tap of transformers, but I bet they don't use transformers, do they?
Well, yeah, I looked at that, and that's what I discussed specifically. And that would, if the clock, continuous clock, always talk. Problem is with SP is that once you send, you stop. And so if you try to use a trend, a couple, and you stop toggling the signal at state.
Yeah, yeah. So that would, that's, so it begins to seem like I2C might be better, but then you've got the problem with the bi-directional data line, which is you have to rig that up with RS-485 drivers to be able to do that.
Yeah, I haven't looked at SPI to see how wires it would, I'm sorry, I2C, but the SPI is four pairs or eight wires. In looking at it, I'm going to guess that SP works, but when it sees stop, it probably times out to understand, because otherwise it falls the receiver basically. And so I'm going to guess the uses in the resync.
Well, the SPI uses four wires. It doesn't have a chip select that they toggle at the end of the command.
You don't have to do that. I left the clock select out and figured normally clock select will SP receive gets. And since case we want to hardwire the select receiver to eliminate one signal, but that still gets us clock, you know, data out, data in, and return. That's where I'm a little stuck. I'm wondering, we may be able to send a read commands, which may toggle the lines and not the transformers restart. So any of these things, there's a possibility.
Well, so what is the point of having the return clock? Can't you just source the clock from one end like a typical SPI port?
Well, it depends on the amount of delay in the cable. So if you send a clock from the transmitter to the receiver, and let's say it takes 100 nanoseconds, the receiver clock out the data, so that data takes another nanosecond to get back to the transmitter. So the receive time, the sourcing.
Right, so you just have to make sure you use a slow enough clock.
Yeah, that's a possibility. In the TI note, what they did is they looped the clock back at the receiver and sent it back, and that maintained it synchronous. But if, you know, if we can run slow enough, we don't have to talk back, then that would free up two wires that we use to power.
Or maybe those I2C extenders that Dave put the link there to, maybe that could be adapted for use in fewer than four pair.
Okay, I didn't see the link. Maybe I'm on the wrong. Oh, I'm on the wrong channel.
Yeah, you click the Tangerine SDR tab at the bottom there.
Yeah, it always defaults to the other tab, and I go change. So those are worth looking at since the magnetometer has an ice. Let me go look at those modules. If we can get everything in eight wires, it sure is nice to.
Yeah, and I imagine the power this thing draws is so infinitesimal that you can run power and ground on one pair, and clock on another, and data on another, and then you'd have a free pair for, you know, Morse code.
Yeah, yeah. I'll have to look at the data sheets Dave has. Typically, I2C uses resistive pull-ups, traditional variables.
Oh, yeah, really. Oh, yeah, that's for sure. And I think we want to be able to do more than 100 feet, too. So I know one of the things that I found was much more effective than anything with resistive pull-ups was current loop-type drivers.
Yeah, the 485, of course, you terminate the receiver ohms because that the impedance of a differential pair in Cat 5, Cat 6 ohms, and so it's a transmission of those effects. But I'll capture the links that Dave put down there and go take a look at that. Maybe that's a bit.
Yeah, and that's why I added the PMOD, or I have the PMOD connectors there, because those are so they were developed by Digilent, and there are just literally hundreds of functions that you can buy that plug in on PMODs. And actually a PMOD is really, I believe, only six pins. And when you use the 12-pin connector, you get things like an interrupt and a chip select and thing, you know, stuff that we really don't need, but it becomes a standard interface. And I think they fit pretty nicely on the back in between the where the clock module will be and where the RF boards will be on the front. So we can actually use through-hole connectors. Because I don't like using SMT connectors if I can avoid it that have any kind of anything that plugs in that has any kind of pull on them.
Yeah, I agree with that. In looking it over, I think we may want to build the extender shield connectors, and that way I'm worried radiation problems from the cable if we don't using a shield. And so if we put the shield style extender ends, then if we do need shields, easy to.
Okay, because the PMODs can be run on a ribbon and extended out, or you can plug the boards directly on them, because they're designed to have a right angle female on the main board and right angle male headers on the PMOD adapters. the PMOD function boards, so they just plug on and kind of hang off to the side.
Okay. Yeah, I was discussing the RJ45 connectors, the extender. I have never looked at PMOD. Do you have a good reference to where to learn about?
Yeah, digilent.com, digilent.com. I'll see if I can find the link and put it down.
Okay, well, I will do some, if I like what I see, might update the pretty preliminary specs.
Yeah, I'm not sure how that link that I put down there will be. I just grabbed it really quick, but they're kind of like the granddaddy of PMOD. So if they don't say what it is, a quick Google will find you tons and tons of us. I think they even have a specification, which is more than I can say for things like Arduino shields.
Okay, very good. I noticed on the document list that me down for the RF. Is that something to get started?
Oh, I don't know. I just put you down because being an experienced RF guy, I thought you would be the one. So yeah, if you want to, that would be good. And I think I managed to get Bill's two documents released on that list too, on the second page.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I'll take a stab at the RF module. That at least, once we have that, at least we'll have a spec for every module in the packet.
And I'm thinking the RF module is probably the one that we're going to have the most variants of.
Yeah, possibly. That's a good point. We'll have to figure out how to organize the document so we can address multiple variants, all the ones that we've done so far. We haven't really considered.
Yeah, I was talking to my business partner here today about how to do that and wondering, well, should we have a functional document for the type of module that would list all the variants and then a separate ICD for each one? And he says, no, you don't want to do that. You want to have an ICD that covers all of them, which gives you like mins and maxes and examples. So it sounds like the functional requirements and the ICD are going to have sections for each variant that we make, and we'll just add new ones as we go, I guess, is the easiest way.
Okay, very good. We can add another section number called product variants or something. We'll have tables that list versions module. Hopefully most information is com variants, and so document nice to just have once.
Yeah, I even made up a table of prospective part numbers and names for them. So like, for instance, you're going to love this. For the 2 clock modules, you could have the Tangerine Inexpensive Clock and the Tangerine, I can't remember what the other one, but they were going to be Tick and Talk for the 2 clock modules.
That would make John Ackerman most happy.
It was inspired by John, that for sure.
Okay, I will, I'm going to try to scale some module and put in some preliminary information into a clock module ICD mix, whatever else I can for the magnetometer extend specs. So that's a good start. I'll work on that this week.
Okay, great. Yeah, it would be good to know that we can actually fit the proposed pieces into that outline. I did this totally devoid of any electrical requirements or functional requirements whatsoever, merely a what will fit inside the Raspberry Pi N2 kind of envelope. And I wanted to really avoid having the thing just grow and grow and grow, and you know, the creeping elegance problem until you end up with a board the size of a PC motherboard.
Yeah, I have not had a chance to Remus our QEX, but I noticed photograph of it that it's a rather substantially sized.
Yes, it's quite a bit larger than the regular Atlas by another half or a third.
Yeah,
to the main bus though, right?
Same bus, but the board will stick up above. Say if you have a Pandora box, it would not fit inside.
Yeah, so I looked at it and I noticed U-Blocks M6, which is an older module, but I don't know the difference between the 6 and the 8, and I just haven't had time to read his article to see why there's so much circuit. My hope was we much, because it looks like the M8 contains a lot of that functionality. Rick is probably the expert.
He did most of that work 3 or so years ago. I remember when he was talking about it on SDR. And so there were some downtimes where he wasn't working as actively. So this article's kind of like the summary report after it's all he's got working version.
Okay, understand. The question I would have is the difference between the M6 that used and the 8. The best news rates a lot in the 6, and so we don't need the big board. I'm not sure.
Maybe I should comment a little bit. First of all, there's no M6. There's a 6 series and an 8 series and a 9 series. The 8 series doesn't, not all of the 8 series has all the functionality we like. It's very specifically the M8F, which is of interest, because the M8F has the unique ability to steer either the internal oscillator that's inside itself, because it's a PC board with a bunch of parts under a little metal can, or an external oscillator, which is good and as expensive as you want. And I've used that circuit extensively, and it saves a great deal of parts and software, all kinds of stuff. An M8F will just take away all the problems associated with steering and bring it, even if you have an external oscillator, it brings it down to just a D to A, a couple of RC filter parts, oscillator. Pretty much that's it. Really nice arrangement if, and this is where John Ackerman's been looking into, if it'll meet our specification for stability and jitter and phase noise and so forth. We're not 100% sure will, but anyway, it's super simple. The 6s require quite a bit of extra to do the same thing, as do most of the 8s. The M9 is the one I'm particularly interested in, but it's not clear that there's going to be a version of the M9 that steers oscillator. I don't know about that yet. Anyway, the M8F is a very unique device in terms of its ability to steer the oscillator and importantly for us, also to make use of that oscillator, which most of the circuits I've seen don't. Anyway, I can go on and on. It's the M8F is my read, and I wouldn't spend a whole lot of time looking at an old article, because those of us who designed things the old way won't go back if we can help it.
Okay, that answers the question. You may save me enough reading to other spec.
It all depends on John's evaluation of some of our alternatives regarding how good a job the M8F does in steering the oscillator, and is it good enough? But certainly in terms of circuitry, it's the most cost-effective and powerful solution we have.
Okay, very good. Do you have a list of kin oscillators, external oscillators?
No. I say no. John's initial evaluation was the cheapest possible, and that was the internal oscillator that's already in the modules, having it steer that. And John's quick suggestion is, without having tweaked all of the adjustments we made through software, it appears that that's not good enough. I use an oscillator that I have to buy 50 at a time at $110 or $115 a piece. I think that's on the other side of our project goals. That's too expensive in quantity 50. So we'll have to find something between, I suspect.
Okay. I sent John a bunch of questions, probably 6 back. So
yeah, aren't we all? I'm hoping to get to work with John on this particular problem, because I have a lot of interest in finding out what we can do better through adjusting various parameters that are available in the commands to the M8F. And I certainly play around with it a lot. I have everything I need except one piece of it. That one piece of it is the phase meter that John's using, which is no longer available, a new version of which is available, but at a cost of $13,000, and that just set me back.
Okay, so we may want to have you and John think about this for a come-up proposal or something.
Well, the good news is we're not quite up to the design spec yet, but we're getting awfully close to it, so we're going to have to do something.
And Rick, I wouldn't rule out that expensive oscillator, perhaps not for this application, but John's talking about making a little carrier board so that you can take our clock module and actually use it for something useful. And that high-performance oscillator on the clock module might just be something that enough people would buy to make it worthwhile. Maybe not for a personal space weather station, but for other applications.
Yeah. I am willing to make available in quantity one or greater the oscillator that I'm using at the quantity 50 price. You know, so, because it just helps me burn through them quicker and I can order more. So it's not a problem for me to, you couldn't buy them at twice that price in quantity. But it's, I thought maybe that was too much. I think we can find for the space station, I don't think we need this fancy OCXO thing. I think we can use a good TCX to do the job.
Yeah. Put the link down there to that oscillator so we can take a look at it. Do something quick?
Not so much. They turns out when you're ordering oscillators of this type, they tend to be, even if they you think they have standard part numbers, they wind up not being. I'll have to, I'll come up with something and send it out by email.
Okay, it would, you know, potential here may be that, you know, we can mount a different oscillator. We can mount the John's oscillator. We can mount the much less expensive oscillator the space weather station use. So solve the issue that. So, Rick, are you going to be talking with John about this?
I will endeavor to do that if I can get a hold of him.
Okay, I understand.
I was hoping we might get him to join us here on TeamSpeak. I'll send him another invite. Also, I want to congratulate Bill for getting the disk writes up on the N2. That's a pretty big accomplishment, I think, that we kind of glossed over.
Well, I don't know that it's, I'm not sure. I didn't want to crow about it too much because I'm not sure it's really working right. I figure I let it run for an hour and it didn't crash. It didn't get any sequence errors, but it only produced 12 gigabytes of data. And I was expecting it to produce about 80 gigabytes of data. That's what we expect to receive at our full data collection rate. That's what gives us our 2 terabytes of data per day. And so I'm sitting down here. I'm going to look at this code again. I'm not sure it's right, but I mean, at least I do have one solution that doesn't skip samples. So at least we'll be able to characterize what is a maximum sample rate we can collect with the Odroid N2.
Yeah, and that'll be very valuable. Go ahead, Phil.
I was going to say, when you get to the point where you're generating, you know, enough data that it's looking like it's generating data and recording it on disk at the rate that you expect, then there's unfortunately no way around making sure that you're not silently dropping samples by taking a look at looking for phase glitches. You know, at one point or another, one always ends up there, even if you just want to convince yourself that things are going okay. But I completely agree. The first thing to do is just to do the sanity check of, wait a minute, you know, are there enough samples here? So you're on the right track.
Does the protocol have packet numbers in it?
I'm trying to remember. What I know that when you ask for, I only know at the client side, when you ask for a contiguous block, it will say, I'm going to say, I want to start at this universal time.
Okay.
I'd like to go for 1,000 samples. It will either give you the full 1,000 samples or it will give you 500 and say, sorry, I'll give you 500, but I can guarantee that they're contiguous. So there are some sequence numbers in there, but I'm going to have to refresh my memory as to how they're arranged. More or less, we're, again, indexing by, you know, our time indexing is the universal time times the sample rate. That's our sort of absolute sample index if you go look underneath the protocol. And that may take the place of number, actually.
But then the idea is you could do some post-processing on the 80 gig of data or however much data it is to confirm that you didn't drop anything with post-processing program.
Yes, right. And there may be a lighter weight way to do that. We can get there when we get there. Yes.
Scotty, it's we've hit 7 p.m., so I'm...
Okay. Well, I think it's probably, unless there's other questions, it's a good time for us to kind of limit this to an hour. So I'm with you. Any other questions?
Thank you very much for the mechanics. Much appreciated.
Okay, well, I hope they meant something. Looked like they're consistent anyway, and they might actually have a chance to work. What I was kind of aiming for was more of like a brick rather than a flat, like a a rack panel width worth of stuff.
I just sent out the oscillator data. I was able to find it.
Oh, okay. Great. Thanks, Rick.
Very good. Is that, that's an OC, it's an oven?
It's an unusual one. It's a direct heated, yes.
Okay, understand. So that's the one that's kind of performance side?
Yeah, and they have, if you look through the website, they have even higher performance oscillators. This is unique in that it's very low power and will run on, there's versions that will run on either 5 or 3 volts. The ones that I have are 5 volts. And I should have said in there that it's 10 megahertz. Well, it's available in many other places, but 10 megahertz is.
Okay.
And
okay.
By the way, I have two boxes sitting here that I'm looking at. One is, and two, I'm looking for something to do with that. Sounds like I'll have something interesting to do with that soon, derivative of what's going on here. I also have a box of the modules from Digilent, quite a large box of them, because my Xilinx develops that interface extensively.
Yep, that's kind of the reason we picked a standard expansion module. So you'll be able to plug all those in and do something with
it. Oh, yeah, I got all kinds of D-Days and A-to-Ds and other, even displays, all kinds of. It's a fun little interface. It's super.
Very good. Thanks for the link. I've got it. I'll put it out in the notes and note that it's 10.
Just a curiosity question. Scotty, is there anything in the data engine that's going to run fast enough to get hot that has to have cooling?
Probably not on this version of data engine, but on a subsequent version where we put a Cyclone 5 CVA9, like a 300K LE FPGA on there, there probably will be either a little heat sink or some, we'll have to put a fan on it. So we're going to have to, you probably noticed that pretty much the entire data engine is covered with modules. So we'll have to address that at some point.
Yeah, I was just wondering because the N2, even after running for an hour at in excess of 80% on all four of the fast CPU modules, really only got a little bit warmer than it was. So at least we know that the Odroid can run flat out without having any thermal problem. it might be, I mean, you are talking about put another heat sink on the data engine that might be on, like, on the top of it. Are you thinking that, like, the data engine's going to be on the top?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. And so the hat, the low speed hat, will cover that area there that I'm thinking the FPGA is going to be. So what may happen is that you have to put a hat on there that is a cooling module, and you'll be out of luck for a hat, or you'll have to stack the hat, you know, one board up, because the hats do have pins on the top and sockets on the bottom, and you can theoretically stack multiple ones. So we might have a hat that just has a fan that sits right over the FPGA. And we stick on a heatsink on the FPGA. That was sufficient in the IQ2 SDR to get the heat out, as long as you have a consistent airflow. So, are any other questions before we shut down here and let Tom go? Well, I want to thank everyone, and we'll see you all next week. Thanks to Dave for running the show, and everyone for pitching in, and Mike for recording. And sounds like we've got a good team here with lots of things to get done.